All right. Next up, we have Chris Butcher from Bungie, who's going to talk about Halo 2, which has recently shipped and been enjoyed by a great many people. Before I hand it over to him, I just want to make a sort of process of the lecture thing comment, which is Chris has indicated that he actually doesn't mind, you know, people asking questions in the middle of the talk, but at the same time, I want to still maintain some structure and prevent an avalanche of, like, question. So if you have a question, but somebody else gets it in before you, maybe wait a little bit, and if it's the time for it passes, we'll pick it up at the end Q&A. So strike a fine balance there. But please help me welcome Chris Butcher.
Hi, guys. Well, as the slide says, I'm Chris Butcher. I've been lucky enough to be working at Bungie for a little under 5 years. So a lot of what I'm going to be talking about today is not my work, hence the 55 other people on the slide. You know, all of this is very much a group effort. Some of them are here today, in fact, so they'll be making sure I don't take credit for anything that's unduly deserved. So it's really interesting to be talking second today, to be talking right after Jay, because I think there's actually been a lot of parallel evolution in what I think our goals are for developing content and process and those sorts of things. So it's nice to be talking after that, because I think Jay spent a long time talking about what the goals are and why they're important. And he's right, and you should listen to him. And what I'm going to talk about is a little bit of a background on how we go about technically achieving some of those goals to greater and lesser success. So what I'm going to start by talking about is a little bit about the ancestry of the Halo engine to give a little bit of perspective on how we got to where we are. I'm going to talk about some statistics for how much stuff we have and how much we do. And then there are two main things I want to talk about. One of them is I want to talk about the model we have for resources, that is the static data that we use to build our world. And I'm going to talk a little bit about our runtime data, that is everything that's not that, everything that's the state of the engine, state of the world, and state of things going on within it. So the Halo engine actually is basically as old as Bungie itself. You can draw a line back to the first game that Bungie really wrote, which was a 3D game, which was Pathways into Darkness, which was written by one of our co-founders in 1992. Now, it's a little bit silly to say it's the same engine, because hardly any of that code is the same. There's just a little bit of stuff like math functions, I guess, although those math functions have transitioned from fixed point to floating point over the years. But a lot of the philosophy and the fundamental underlying structures are still very old. There are deep roots there. So a lot of the underlying stuff we have is written in C rather than C++, although there is more and more C++ these days in the engine as people start building more code. And the fundamental foundations of the engine really are platform neutral, because it's over the time we've had the single code base operating on the PC, Mac, Linux, Xbox, and PlayStation 2, although we never shipped anything on some of those platforms. But fundamentally, there's a distinction between the PC kind of development environment and the console target environment. So that's there's going to be a thread that you'll see throughout what I'm talking about here today. Another thing to note is that at its heart, really the Halo engine is a world simulation engine. I throw this in here because a lot of the time when you start up with a new engine, you are typically building an engine that is about the player's interaction with the world. So, for example, a lot of the Quake stuff early on was very much about here is the world from a rendering perspective, and here is the world built from the perspective of how the player interacts with it. Well, what we have now, after all this time, really is an engine whose fundamental principles are about simulating a world and things inside that world, and then really the player and the player's interface is kind of this thin shell built on top of that. The player really is not even a first-class citizen in the world. Although a lot of things in the world happen because of him and around him, the player, from a code system, really is not the heart of the engine. So I want to start with a few numbers, because we can get the concrete stuff out of the way, then get down to philosophy. The Halo engine's about 1.5 million lines of code. That does not include any of the libraries we use. That does not include Havoc, for example, which I think is a fair fraction of that size. And that also doesn't include, as you think it might, like a bunch of dead code. Like, there isn't 200,000 lines of Macintosh code in there. That really is pretty much genuinely stuff that we are using in our tools and our engine to date. Our build times, I think, are fairly decent, around 7 minutes for a build that you'll be running on your Xbox. Can I get a show of hands? Who thinks that's terrible? I actually don't know what build times are like in the industry these days, really, but maybe I'll get a chance to talk to more of you later. Shipping build, link time code generation is more. If you're building all of the binaries for the engine, that is something like 12 or 13 binaries for all of our tools and Xboxes, we run that on a build site. It takes about 20 minutes. And to build the complete game and compile all the resources is a little under an hour on our build farm. Shipping executable is just over 4.8 megabytes, which really is kind of ridiculous, I think. That's grown significantly from Halo 1 to Halo 2, mostly because of we've added Havoc, and which is a fairly significant amount of code. And a lot of systems in our engine have grown more complex with the addition of more and more complex simulation architectures that underlie the basis of the game. Code bloat is going to be a really difficult thing to address in the next generation of consoles, and it's a problem that we're going to have to start dealing with very, very soon. So as far as the resources we have go, we have about 70 gigabytes under source control. We use Source Depot for that, which is a Microsoft internal tool, which is essentially Perforce with a custom GUI on top of it and some custom backend stuff. That does not count any of the localized content. Although we shipped 8 languages simultaneously, the localization probably adds about another 200 gigabytes on top of that, because the bulk of data that we have in source control really does turn out to be audio for pretty obvious reasons. So that's how much data we actually have, but obviously we don't load all of that every time we load a level. Our level loads about 4 minutes on the Xbox for the development version of our game, and that's for a non-compiled version of the level. I'll talk about that later. If you wanted to compile that level, that would take on the order of 10 minutes or so, and then you can load that level in under a second. That 700 milliseconds there is really just a rough guess. I haven't timed it recently, but it is some not insignificant fraction of a second to load a level. And the final shipping game comes on an Xbox DVD-9. It's 4.2 gigabytes, and there are 8 of them that we shipped simultaneously. So talking about the development of our engine, it's been in development for 34 months, realistically about 3 years between releases. And these two pie graphs here, the one on the left here is development staff, and the one on the right is our production and support staff. So because not all of you can probably read these, I'll go over these. This is our engineering team, 17 engineers. These numbers are all at peak from the largest size they ever got to, which was, you know, about a month before we ended up shipping the game. So those 17 engineers are divided in a similar fashion to how Jay was talking about. Although we had 4 senior engineers leading up different kind of feature teams at the end. And really, our engineering team was about 12 people for the majority of the project, you know, staffing up a little bit more towards the end for UI and Xbox Live stuff and things like that. So our design team here, these are both game designers and also level designers. The role of level design for us is the person who's synthesizing everything. They're putting it all together in the level. So they are not people who are building level geometry. That's these people, the environment artists. The largest group of our artists is 11 of them. And we have 8 people working on 3D and 2D modeling and texturing, basically building objects for the world. We have 1 technical artist, and we have 6 animators, both cinematic animation and game animation. That, and we also should fairly note that we did outsource some cinematic animation over the course of the game. That was simply just so we could hit our deadlines for cinematic production. And 3 producers and 3 sound designers. So that's a total of 56 core development people at the end, although realistically more like 45 to 50 over the course of the project. So over here is our production staff. 2 administrative people, 8 people working on website and community stuff. That's higher than it would normally be because we also launched a completely new website with Halo 2. So that's probably going to be about 4 people for sustaining content. We have 5 people in our test engineering group. It's an interesting group I want to talk about a little bit. So we divide the engineering responsibility at Bungie up a little bit because we have an in-house testing group, and they can pull resources from Microsoft Test, but most of the core people who are running the testing group are full-time Bungie employees. So those test engineers are building stuff that's really crucial to our development effort. Our engineers over on the production, over on the development side, are building all of the tools the artists will be interacting with every day, and they're actually building the game. Our test engineers are building all of the support and infrastructure for us. So for example, they developed our build farm, our lightmap farm, they did our automated crash detection and analysis tools, and they did our distributed internet upload servers and things like that. And also helped out with the website work. So this section here is all testing. These are people who we staffed up in the last half of the project. This is the peak, obviously. So there's 10 full-time test staff that are actually Bungie employees or full-time staff we borrowed from other Microsoft. That would be only typically 4 or 5 for the most of the project. Then 20 contract testers and 14 testers just doing localization work, essentially translators. Rather, I should say, they are people who are checking the accuracy of the translation. They are not the actual localization group. So with that out of the way, I'm now moving on to the actual meat of the talk. So that's all the pictures you guys are going to see for this talk. The rest is all just words. Because of that, it's kind of difficult to verbally describe some of this stuff. So if there is anything that is unclear, stop me, and I'll make sure I explain it in more detail. So what I'm going to talk about when I talk about our resource model is I'm going to really go into more detail on how we store resources that then are used to load the game and really populate the world. So we have a unified organization for our resources that are called tags. I'll explain that in a minute. So I'm going to talk about the way those are organized as a file system. I'm going to talk about the unified tools we use to edit them. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the loading process, what it actually means to load resources in our game. And then finally, the level compiling process and our on-console memory layout and streaming architecture. So the tag resource system, the name is kind of a historical artifact. I'm going to describe a little bit briefly about that. Back in Marathon days, I guess 1994, Bungie was doing solely Macintosh development. So all of our resources were stored in the native Mac resource format, where you would identify a resource by a 4-character tag, like CLUT or .256, that describe the type of resource. And then within that, there's a flat organization where you're basically indexing by ID. So that's how Marathon worked for all of its resources. Prior to using the resource model, our resources would be basically hard-coded C tables full of structures. Like, here are the monster definitions for the 8 monsters in the game. They're right here in this C file. But then in the Marathon timeline, we started breaking more of those out into resources. And then come Myth, 1995, really starting to do cross-platform development between PC and Macintosh. So essentially, Myth used a file system which was a cross-platform nature. So you would go and look in the CLUT folder, and there'd be a series of files there that were named. So there's no hierarchical organization. You know, if there are 25 different units in the game, they would be in that one folder, and you would look for the file named Warrior. So come Halo, the original Halo engine back on the PC for the first year or so of development used a similar system where it was flat and non-hierarchical. But eventually this amount of content in the engine just grew so that we had to add hierarchy to the system. All took place before I was at Bungie. So it, essentially now, in its current form, it's a singly rooted hierarchical namespace where you can identify a resource by a type, such as biped, or scenario, or bitmap, and a path to it, in this case, objects, characters, grunt. So that directly maps to a file which is stored on your host system. So we don't store things in a big SQL database. It is file system-based, and just under a simple directory. None of this is rocket science. I'm going to go pretty quickly through it since you guys probably do similar things already. But one thing that we do, which is 99.99% of all of our data is stored as one of these tag files. There are really very few exceptions that don't follow this unified memory format. The exceptions are things that are not part of a level, things that you need to access through your game engine when you're not actually, when you actually don't have loaded some area or level of space. So there's really only a couple of exceptions, things like loading screens and fonts. We still have direct file mappings for those, but everything else works through the tag system. So what is a tag? Well, this is really quite hard to describe verbally, but let me know if this is making sense. We build a tag up as a hierarchical data structure where the fundamental building block is a variable length array of fixed elements. That is, if I am creating a tag which contains AI definitions, then a block within that tag might be a particular AI structure, and there might be 8 of them, or 0 of them, or 13 of them. So they're stored contiguously. And it's hierarchical because the topmost block, that is, if it's a biped tag, then the topmost block is a biped C structure, contains exactly one element. So then each of these blocks is built up of elements, and the elements within a block are built from atomic fields, like integers, enumerations, floating point, string, text. You also can take these fields, and although they are syntactically identical, you can put semantic representations on top of them. So, for example, you can have an integer field, which is defined as a flag field. Therefore, everything that uses it and accesses it will treat it as a series of Boolean flags. Similarly, you could take a set of floating point numbers, and instead of actually representing them as direct floating point numbers, you could say, I want a map function here, which is a collection of enumerations and real floating point values, which then can be edited as a spline or whatever kind of function, or a pixel shader instead of a text field. So those are the atomic blocks, but the hierarchical nature comes from the fact that inside a block element, you can have atomic fields which are child blocks themselves. So if I have a biped definition, and suppose a biped has some number of legs, then there would be a tag block which is a block of legs, which is embedded in the middle of the biped block, and again, 0 to n elements. You can also embed binary data blobs in here. So essentially, you can build any hierarchical data structure that you want to, but again, operating within these limits. And this is kind of a philosophy we use all over our engine, which is to create a generalized system for describing things and then apply it to absolutely everything and not let people step outside the bounds. So you really can't load a target file from disk if you want to. You're not allowed to do that. You have to do it within the context of the tag file system. And they're hierarchical not just within a single tag, but through references to other tags by which you can pull in data from other parts of the game database.
It's a reference to another tag, one of your fundamental tags.
Yeah. So what are the blocks mapped as? Well, so I was talking about a block of AI properties, right? If I have a block of AI properties, then the individual element will be defined as a C structure. So this is one element in a block, and then a block could have some number of these. Simple C structure. We also have to have a duplicate definition of it, which is done as a macro, this macro defining a structure of a certain type that contains definitions of the atomic types within it. So this is both a strength and a weakness of the system. It's a strength in that it allows introspection of the data, but it's a weakness because you have to define them separately. You could do this through pre-processing a header file, which was marked up with comments and macros, so that there was only a single definition. We've thought about doing that in the past. We actually did it on Oni, which was a separate engine to the Halo engine. But, I don't know. The discussion of the reasons is probably would take too long, and I'm just at the start of the talk. But this is the way we do it at the moment. So each of these you can see is a atomic type, name, and this here can contain extra markup information about what it is and how it should be used. And then there's an optional parameter, which is a pointer to a more complex definition, where that definition would be another macro-defined structure. So for the flags field, this pointer points to another definition, which defines what are the flags that are in that integer field and how are they defined. If it was a function that you were defining there, there would be a pointer to a function definition. So let me move on and talk about why we do this. Again, like I said, it allows introspection. And what this means is that essentially every resource that we load in our game, it can be introspected in this way. So this basically lets us do automatic serialization. The serialization is very simple. The file format is not text-based, it is binary-based. And because, for historical reasons, it's all based on essentially the Macintosh resource format, which is very, it's a binary description, which is very close to the runtime nature of that resource. Again, the mapping between the in-memory and the on-disk version is very close. So the file format for a block is just It is that block. It is those C structures laid out in the file. So it's not the case that you have an integer field that's written as type integer name AI, you know, value 4. That is just it's a 4-byte field on disk that has the value 4 in it. So there are pretty obvious weaknesses to that, of course. The most obvious one is that it requires that you have an exactly matching definition in code to the definition of the tag that was used to write the tag out. If there's a mismatch, then we don't have any advanced checking to say things like, you know, you skipped over a field here, or you thought this thing was a string, but actually it's a real value. So you can get yourself in pretty hot water with this, particularly because we have only limited support for versioning in our engine. We do have some simple automatic versioning which allows you to add fields to a block at the end of the block, and the reason for that is because you can the file format for an individual block is basically here is the block type and here is its total length and the number of counter fields and here they all are. But so when you are loading a tag, if you don't have explicit versioning information, but you do know that the field on disk is shorter than what you are expecting, then you can pad it out at the end with zeros, essentially. So there are simple kinds of ways in which you can avoid having to do versioning explicitly. But for anything that involves moving fields around or changing a field of one type to another, you have to do explicit versioning in code. And the way we do that is really basic, which is that we keep around in code the version 1, version 2, and version 3 versions of those structures, both the C file, both the C structure, and also the definition macro that built it. And then you have to write explicitly functions to convert between them. And obviously, you know, there are pitfalls with this. It's very easy for you to write a versioning function which is not exactly correct, and you may not know it immediately. In development, we frequently would, well, not frequently, maybe 4 or 5 times over the course of development, would come upon a situation where there was a file that was just missing data. That data was zeroed out or had been nulled out by our bounds checking because some point in the past there had been a versioning conflict or some artist had opened the file with an old version of a tool and then saved it again, things like that. So essentially what I'm pointing out here is that we were able to make the game and ship it, and I think we're all very happy with the resource model. There are flaws, but fundamentally the basics are really basic that it's built on. So the other things that this provides is, again, it's automatic serialization. It allows us to byte swap on load and save, which is very important when you're doing cross-platform work. Not as important right now. All of our big NEM systems are deprecated, but those, of course, may be coming back in the near future. But one of the nice things about this introspection is that you can take a structure, load it off disk, and what happens is that it gets exploded into individual blocks. We don't load the file as a single binary blob. We load each block as a separate memory allocation. And then those memory allocations are variable length arrays that can be reallocated as necessary and moved around. So what that means is that you can have an automatic way of saying, I have this resource, which I know by a handle. I'd like you to make a complete copy of it and give me this new resource. And you can do that. You can also, at any point in the hierarchy, say, there are 4 AI properties. I want to insert one at index 2. Go and do that without damaging the rest of the structure. So this duplication, insertion, and deletion is very important because it can happen automatically through the structures that we have to describe it. But there's an important note here, which is that this introspection comes at a price. There's a certain amount of overhead you have to pay for having these structures around. And none of the things that we use it for are needed at runtime. And by runtime, I mean the shipping console version. So you don't need to load these byte swap formats on a console. You don't need to do any modification of your static data. So it all goes away completely. And the only access to tags on the shipping version is when you know explicitly what the type of tag block is that you're accessing, so you can just get to it directly because you have a pointer, you know the size of the element, you can go there directly. So what our tags are, then, is 11.6 gigabytes of data in 39,000 individual files in our database. So like I said before, there are dependencies from one tag to the next. So if you want to load a level, there are really only two things you do. First, you load a single tag, which is the globals tag. You load a single tag, which is the scenario that you're loading. Then you go and resolve all the hierarchical dependencies. That's it. You're done. But that process is going to pull in about 8,000 files with various kinds of data in them for a typical level. So interestingly enough, you can see roughly 20% of our data is used on any given level. That fraction is higher than I was expecting when I went and generated this. So we have 130 different types of tag, and here's a pie graph, and I'm going to call these out for you. These are sounds, bitmaps, shaders, render models, object models, collision models, effects, animation graphs, physics models, and everything else. So fairly standard, but it's interesting to look at the proportions. Sound drastically outweighs everything else, which is true about just about everything in our engine. And I think some of the later data that I have to show you will be quite surprising.
Hey,
yeah. Yeah, we typically we would do that for things like here are the pixels for a bitmap.
Right. So do you have a special
markup that needs to be
allocations for that?
Do we have specially marked up information that needs to be
marked in the tags, whether or not the tag needs to be allocated for or not?
Right. Well, essentially I'll talk about that when I talk about loading these things from disk in more detail, but the quick answer is that the tag file format is platform neutral, and when they are loaded into memory, that is the time which you do any platform-specific work, including turning data into contiguous versions of itself.
Was the paragraph memory size or number of tags?
It was number of tags. Okay, so now I'm going to show you this tool, which is called Gorilla. This is running in 1024 by 768, but this is the tool that we use to edit all of our data. So you can see here is the tags hierarchy on the left, which shows every tag in the database. This also doubles our source control client, so you can see I can collapse all of this. It's all red, indicating it couldn't access the source control server, which is probably not very surprising. Essentially, that would also show you, you know, what is the status? Do I have it checked out on my machine? Who has it checked out? Do I have a writable version of it? That sort of thing. So what I've opened here is a single tag. This is one asset. In this case, this is the biped tag that corresponds to a grunt character in the game. So as I scroll down here, you can see this is automatically generated UI. It looks very much like automatically generated UI. There are real values. There are colors. There are enumerated types here. That sort of thing. And this can be marked up a little bit. So you see here, this is a bounding radius, this 0.4, but it's been marked up to say the units are world units. And here's an acceleration scale, it's 1.5, and someone has annotated that it can be between 0 and positive infinity. And if I mouse over it, there's an additional thing there, which someone has added that says, you know, here are some sample values that you could use. So that's what these fields look like. These are atomic fields. Then here, for example, is a tag block. You can see I can open and close it, and I can add, insert, delete information from that block. If I go down here, here's a block that has multiple entries in it. Basically, you can scroll down here, up and down. You can see here are the different blocks in here. So you can imagine this is hierarchical, and that essentially we're looking at a hierarchical view of the tag. We're just looking at this one specific part. So these fields here, like I said, these are real value fields, but they're overloaded to be a color, so I can use a color picker on it. And of course, there are lots more complex things you can do. You can have a function editor that goes in there. You could have a set of sound properties that when you click on it, it pops up a mixing board that somebody wrote a custom UI for and stuff like that. But it is all inside the same fundamental editing UI. So this is really just this one application that does it all for us. So this application is linked against the... Oh, rats. It's linked against the same same libraries. Sorry? Right. So it's linked against it's linked against the same libraries, so it has all of the introspection of information available to it, which is how it generates the UI. But so it does have information about boundaries and what is valid data and so on. We do not right now do any validation on save, for example. We've talked about doing that, but our model is primarily about validation upon load. rather than upon save. So, like I said, automatically editing UI from the definition. You can add markup fields to format nicely and to have comments and that sort of thing. One problem here is that these markup fields, of course, are added by editing the code definition. So your designers can't actually mark up the tags to describe them how they would like to. It would be nice if the designers could do that, because then they could say things like, this feature does not work, or a sensible value here is 0.4 rather than the 0.2 that it says in the documentation, that sort of thing. So because every part of our data is editable using this, except for anything that's stored in a binary data blob, which has opaque structure that Gorilla does not know about, like, for example, a WAV file has WAV file data that Gorilla does not have a parser for. You can go and manually mess with our spatial subdivision structure or change BSP nodes and stuff like that if you wanted to. So we make these fields hidden or read-only as context depends. And you can get to them if you use expert mode in Gorilla. But primarily, there's a lot of fields in there which would only ever be touched by an automated tool, because all of our tools operate on this same data format. So our map editor, really, when it gets down to it, it's got a nice 3D view and little placement widget handles, but it is just custom UI on top of tags, which is really interesting because I didn't want to run it on my laptop because it takes a lot of memory and I was afraid PowerPoint would choke. But essentially, you have windows inside your map editor which contain inside them the automatically generated edited UI for some subset of the tags that you are editing. But the rest of the tags are just edited implicitly by like all of these different custom UI things. But you can go and make a level in Gorilla, just like you can make a Half-Life 2 level in a text editor if you really wanted to. And yes, all of our command line tools manipulate tags. So that's what tags are, but how do we get anything in there? Well, so we have the concept of source data, which is anything that we have, which is an asset that is not readable by the game. And by that I mean by the actual game application that's built from the game baseline libraries. So two categories, really: source assets that we don't write importers for, and tool-ready intermediate assets. So, you know, PSD and max files. We could, in theory, read PSD files. We don't. Instead, we read TIFF files or AIF files or AS files. In this case, the AS file is a text-based file, which is the output of our export plugin from Max or Maya. So, yeah. Anyway. So the way that this works then is you have command line import tools which take these intermediate file formats and turn them into tags. So here, you guys probably cannot read that from back there, but here is a three paths that I put up here. The first is a path for a max file which specifies some piece of level geometry. The second is a path to the corresponding AS file, the intermediate file, and the third is the tag path for the file that's going to be generated from this. So what happens is the artist specifies, here's the intermediate file that I wish to import. From parsing that file name, we create a mapping between the data directory and the tags directory. So that means that we can, there's a well-specified mapping there. But the interesting thing about this interaction is the process of getting from this max file to this other file here is that the artist did this. They were inside Max and they said, I want to export to this file name. You'll notice this guy called this arcology2.max. It goes to earthcity3.as. You know, that mapping only exists in that artist's head. That's a real problem for us, because essentially it means that there's this relationship between data that it has no representation anywhere in the game. So we're going to try and come up with a smart solution to deal with that, but right now we just don't deal with that. So you can do automated batch processes that go from intermediate file to game-ready file, particularly useful if you want to revision a tag and you don't have time to write a complex versioning procedure, or you fix a bug with a BSP importer, you want to batch import everything, you can do that. In fact, we even make that even simpler, because these tag files, for all of the ones which operate based on intermediate files, the tag itself contains a complete copy of any files that were used to build it. So we actually take this file as a binary blob and embed it inside the tag that's created, so that you can then automatically just say, re-import this, without having to worry if the artists check this stuff in. Of course, we do chase them to check it in, but frequently, we're only about 90% effective actually getting our artists to really check in their data, and we are continuously losing data. Anyway, So the command line import tool is going to produce some number of tags. Now, when I say it produces these tags, if the tags don't exist already, it'll create them. But the way that we handle annotation is that if you're creating a bitmap resource, you don't create that from a TIFF file and then a text file that specifies settings. Instead, what happens is you import the TIFF file once. It creates a bitmap file for you, which has just got the bitmap pixels in it, plus default settings based on what it figured out about that file. Then you can go and you can annotate the tag to change things like, this is the filter coefficients I want, these are the bitmap levels, and then when it is re-imported the next time, it will load the existing tag, figure out the annotation, then replace the automatically generated information inside that tag. So you can probably see where this is going. Of course, interactions with our versioning system here are particularly bad, because if an artist is importing something with an old version of the tool, which they might do if all they ever do is import bitmaps, you know, why do I need to get new code, then you have the potential of loading a newer version of the tag and basically destroying annotation that your tool does not know how to read. So that's a problem we have to deal with in the future. Here's a note about tags. Tags are platform neutral. So what that means is that, for example, if I just imported a max file to import a model of a character or something like that, it's turned that into vertices. We do all of the processing that we can that is still platform neutral. So we, at import time, we'll weld points and edges, we'll build BSPs, all those sorts of things. But our output would be a tag block consisting of vertices where those vertices are just raw values. So our vertex format is a 600-byte vertex, because it contains, you know, 32-bit floating point values for every different kind of component you could have about a vertex. There's no compression or quantization at all in the tag, which is nice because it means the assets you're checking into source control are essentially the most accurate asset you could have. So that means if we want to change something about a vertex compression or quantization, we can make that change in code. We don't have to touch any assets at all. So how do the artists actually use this? Well, the command line import tool is obviously annoying to use if you just want to import a bitmap. So they're integrated into the Gorilla GUI. All of the tags that are there have got a one-click import button that says basically import this tag from its source data again. Or, and when that happens, then they will pop up a window displaying the output of the command line tool and any errors that it found and so on. Alternatively, for extra speed, there's a monitoring mode where you can start a background process that will monitor some subset of your space to say, are there any files whose intermediate files have changed there? If so, try and re-import those tags if the artist has them checked out. So that uses the NTFS file watch notification. So basically, there's this nice process you can have. You're an artist working in Photoshop. I'm working on a character, and I've got 6 PSD files open. I'm fiddling around with some layer, and then I hit the export button. What that does is it's a Photoshop macro which saves the PSD file, flattens it to a TIFF, exports the TIFF to the known name, and then undoes the flatten operation so that it goes back to the layered version of the Photoshop file. So that's a one click, and then that file on disk is monitored, which means that it will be re-imported automatically by the tool and then pumped into the database. So you wouldn't typically do this for anything that could have errors during the import process, and bitmaps typically do not. Like I say, import time's in the 5-second range, except, of course, for level import. Level import takes a long time, and the reason for that is because it's building a BSP and it's doing lots of visibility detection and stuff like that. So that can take 10 to 30 minutes, which is obviously too long for iteration. So that's really not good. One thing that we did is that the artists have access to the release version of our import tool. Problem there is that So our error checking is not done through assertions. If you ever make a tool assert, then that is a bug. But still, assertions are useful because they let you find bugs, whereas if you're using the release version, you would not. So we've had the situation in the past where there will be some bug in our BSP builder that an artist will have uncovered, but they won't know it because the assertions are not there because they're only using the release version of the tool for speed. So what we have is our test engineers built a build verification system, which basically just does background stuff. And one of the things it does is it intermittently goes through and re-imports all the levels using a debug version of the tool to see if there actually are any hidden assertions because the artist was using a release build. So to get back to Charles's question about how does loading really work, well, what we're doing is we're loading the binary file and deserializing it into memory. So there are kind of two modes you load this in, as someone referred to earlier. You can load You can load resources for editing or for gameplay. Loading a resource for editing is basically going to take the binary file and just explode it into memory blocks in memory. It's not going to do a bunch of stuff to actually change the data that's there. And so that's what Gorilla does, for example. You can open a file for editing, and then it is manipulating those memory representation in the same way that the game would manipulate the memory representation, except it has not done bounce checking. And the reason we don't do the bounce check and sanitize there, we could, is because if there's a tag which is messed up on disk, you actually want to look at the messed up version. I want to open something in Gorilla and see QNAN00 against all of my real values and know that something went really badly wrong. I don't want to automatically bounce check those things if you load for editing. That's why we do that. And of course, this uses the markup information that's in the fields to know how you should bounce check and sanitize everything. So after we've, and one thing that we do here, to talk to Steve's point earlier, is we also transform some of our atomic fields into different representations. So there are two kinds of strings we have in our engine. The strings I was talking about as atomic field types are similar to the strings that Jay was talking about earlier. They are symbolic representations. They're ASCII. We also have Unicode strings, totally different path. Those are used for displaying to the user. Our ASCII strings are thrown into a global string table, which turns the string into a 32-bit unique identifier. And then that's what we use to do our comparison operations on, rather than strcomp. The reason we do that is because Halo 1 took about 1% CPU just doing strcomp when you were just sitting there. So after we actually do the deserialization and bounce checking, then you have the opportunity to run what we call post-process operations, which is essentially custom code that can do polymorphic stuff to your tags. So here you can really do anything. You can take a bunch of tag blocks that contain data on disk and process them to some other format and then erase them and then put that new format of a bunch of other tag blocks that were empty when it was stored on disk. So you can do any kind of processing you want to here. This is where we do all that platform-specific runtime data generation. So for example, we load our vertices from disk and we would actually quantize and compress the vertices and then write out a platform-specific vertex buffer. Well, when I say write out, what I mean is you can build a binary blob of data, which doesn't follow the tag format anymore, but it's just a big binary blob. It doesn't need to, because it's not going to be saved out as a tag. This is when you're loading for gameplay. You're never going to save this out as a tag file ever again. But what you can do is you can take a binary blob and write it out as cacheable data to say, you know, I've taken this bitmap, I've DXT compressed it, and here's this buffer of memory. I would like to use this later, so go write it to disk for me. And then you get a handle back. You store the handle in the tag data. And I'll explain later how that actually works with our streaming process. But so one thing about post-processing operations which is interesting here is that you have access to all tags that you depend on. And when I say depend on, I mean that you have a reference to a child tag, and you've marked that reference to say this is a dependent reference. In other words, I want to be able to use this data to modify myself when I load. So if I'm an object and I have a render model, then that's a dependent reference because when I want to find out what my bounding sphere is the time I do my post-processing, I want to look at the vertices of my render model to figure out if my bounding sphere actually contains the render model, that sort of thing. Loading is slow. We're loading thousands of files. Even on the PC, it's not great, but on the Xbox, particularly bad, because the Xbox file system is designed to be memory efficient and really does not work well with this kind of file system. We do a simple thing to try and recover from this, which is rather than having the hierarchy, which is an indefinite number of levels deep, we limit it to be two levels deep. So this little path here is showing that we'll do automatically generated path names where this number here is from 0 to 99, and this is just incrementing. So basically, we're creating a bunch of directories with up to 100 files in each, and as many directories as we need. The reason for that, well, basically the Xbox is a lot faster with smaller files in a directory. And we have a single mapping file which controls the mapping between the Xbox path name and the PC path name. So another reason this is slow is we're doing byte-by-byte processing. Not doing any byte swapping, but we are still like serializing everything in. So that's not going to be fast when you're doing it on hundreds of megabytes. Also, we do hundreds of thousands of memory allocations for each one of these tag blocks to be individually stored. So our memory allocator is deliberately not optimal from a CPU perspective because we don't really use it very much at runtime. So that's a slow part. But essentially, when you add up all of this, our load times are still manageable. They are not great, but they are manageable. 1 to 5 minutes on an Xbox, 1 to 3 minutes on a PC, assuming nothing's in the cache. And then if you do have a file system cache, then about 20 seconds. So if I'm a level designer and I'm starting my level editor, about 20 seconds to start up. These aren't great. We'd like to make this a lot faster. We have ideas to do it, but nothing yet. So why do we do this? Well, the whole reason behind the tag architecture and why it's interesting is you can reload any tag at any time. So the game is running, and there's AI and physics and effects blowing up and everything like that, and you can reload a tag at that point. The way that works is, I said earlier, you can duplicate a tag. Well, you can also, in addition to duplicating a tag, you can load a new tag and then switch the pointers so that the handle for that tag now points to the completely new set of data. There's a couple of big implications. One is the game can never store a pointer ever to tag data. You can store a handle to the tag that is at the topmost level, which is actually an index-based handle, but then anything that you actually want to store has to be done by reference to the internal structure of that tag. Supposing I'm a character with an animation I'm playing right now, I cannot store a pointer to that animation data. Instead, I know what kind of character I am, so that tells me what the tag is I should be using for my animation graph, but I can store, instead of a pointer, an index which refers to the internal structure of that tag. And there are kind of two things that you can choose to store there. One is I could choose to store a string ID, where that lets me know what state I'm in, so it's something I can look up using late binding. Or I can actually choose to store something that tells me what index internally in the tag I have there. Obviously, there are pros and cons to doing both. If I store a string ID, then I don't have to worry about being able to fix that up if the tag is reloaded, because I'll look it up again next time I come through. But if I store an index specifically into that tag, then explicitly, when that tag is reloaded, I'm going to need to have code that knows how to sanity check that. So you can reload anything, any tag. There are a couple of them. The most obvious containers are map files and BSPs. If you reload a level, that is the population information for that level, or you reload the spatial subdivision that underlies that level, it doesn't really make much sense to have the game continue. Like, if I'm in the middle of a fight or something, and then the geometry underlying the world changes, we don't even bother handling that. So they force a level restart. That's important to note, that's not a level load again. It doesn't mean we're going to go and load all the resources. It just means we're going to reset the runtime state and restart the level. So that's a fraction of a second. And we, of course, do things like try and preserve the camera location so the artist who just exited the level, you know, doesn't get disoriented and get jumped back to the start of the level, that sort of thing. But like I said, everything else on the fly. So you have to validate your internal references to the tag. You get a callback after load. You don't get anything before load deliberately. Because if we gave people a callback before load, then people would, in general, start writing code that fixed up everything in the entire game on the prospect that something might be about to be loaded. And we don't allow that. So our policy is basically anything that can crash the game due to reloading or changing assets is a bug that must be fixed by a programmer. And we pretty much aggressively pursued that policy for all but the last couple months of the project. For the last couple months of the project, there are certain things people would do, and it's like, well, you just broke the ability to reload, but we only have a few days to do this feature, so let's get it in anyway. So that's actually a lot easier than it sounds. I can see a lot of you have disbelieving looks on your faces, but essentially, the vast majority of types of resources that we have in our game, because we try and decouple everything as much as possible. We have a graph that contains the animations for one specific character, or we have a shader or a bitmap that's really isolated and separated out on its own. And you have to do that in order to make this work, but one of the advantages of that is that if I change a particular animation graph, then there's really only two ways that something in the runtime state of the world could be referring to the animation graph. It can either be a character or something in the world that explicitly has a handle for the animation graph, in which case it's usually trivial to find everybody that has a handle to a particular animation graph, because there's only a certain number of things that use the animation of that top-level sense in the game. You can go and track those down. The other thing that could happen is there could be some other tag that has a dependency to that tag. So, for example, that animation graph might have been inherited by somebody else. So that somebody else knows they're using the inherited tag, but they actually have a reference internally stored back to that tag structure. Well, the thing I talked about with the post-processing with the dependent references is every time you reload something, you must go and reload anything that depends on those other tags. So the case I was talking about, I have an object with a bounding sphere and it's got a render model. If I was to change that render model, then I must force a reload of the object tag itself. And that reload actually goes all the way back to disk. Even though the disk representation has not changed, the context of the post-processing operations has changed because the tag that it was dependent on, its definition has changed. So you must go and revalidate the bounding sphere. So that essentially is the fundamentals of why that works. As to when it works, PC applications use file system monitoring on the whole tag directory. So if I'm running the editor and I have Source Depot doing a get in the background, then my editor will just be updating stuff as my Source Depot client writes all the files. It's actually kind of scary to not realize that you're doing that. And that happens for our game and for the map editor. But for anything that's not running on a target platform, obviously we don't do a depot sync on that target platform. So you manually initiate the process of copying tags across to the client platform. So you scan the hard drive of the host for changed files, then you copy anything that changed, then you update the central path mapping file I talked about before, the one that maps the tag path to the Xbox file path. So the Xbox client is just watching that single file. With the path mapping file changes, it loads a new path mapping, it compares that to the existing one that it was running with, and it knows which of the files it has to go and reload on disk. So the payoff for all of this work, and it is quite a lot of work, is essentially that we come up with a pretty seamless editing environment. You can change literally any data in the entire game and see it immediately on either your development machine or on the target platform, 3 to 5 second kind of turnaround. So examples of that are, I can be playing on the PC, I like playing on the PC because I have a mouse, and I can encounter some physics object that is unnaturally light or unnaturally heavy. I can open up Gorilla, go to that object, change the property, save the tag, go back into my game, which I just alt-tabbed away from in the background. The physics properties have now changed. I can be an artist who's working on a weapon fire effect or a muzzle flash. It's not showing up at the right location on the object. I can go in and look at it, look at those two tags, look at the spelling, see the spelling is different, correct one, go back in, it will be rebound, it will be showing up in the right place. I can be editing bitmaps for a character. The example I gave earlier with the automatic monitoring is particularly important here. So I have my Photoshop open full screen with 6 different textures in my Photoshop. I paint on the pixels, I hit the save button, I look at my television, and 2 seconds later, my character is updated. So I have the guy on the Xbox standing in a reference lighting environment or standing in a real game environment, and I can change that Photoshop file, the original source asset, and inside a couple of seconds, I'll see what it's really going to look like on my TV, which has been calibrated or not. So it's really nice. It basically puts everybody in the engine all the time. And there's a bunch of interesting things this does. First of all, it actually makes your artists interested in picking up Xbox controllers, which we found otherwise, really, they aren't very interested. A lot of our content really is authored with the target system directly in mind. I say 75% there because there's a couple of kinds of content that are not authored in that sense. Good examples are our environments. Because the import process is... I'm going to skip by a fair amount, yeah.
I'm just saying that.
John's reminding me that we're going a little over time. Yeah. I'll be careful. So our artists, for example, with the level editing, with a 10 to 30 minute import time, that obviously penalizes iteration. So they don't create content directly on the target system. Also, our animators don't. The reason for that is even though the animation import is very fast, it's typically hard for you to set up your test environment in a repeatable fashion. If I'm doing an animation which is a guy boarding another guy in a vehicle, we don't actually have specific tools that let you set up those situations and then replay them over and over again. So if I wanted to do that on the Xbox, I'd have to actually like possess an AI character, make him get in the vehicle, jump out, possess someone else, and actually perform the board, which you do a little bit. Yeah?
It's clear how like Hot Wheels works really well in stateless objects, like bitmaps and shaders and things like that. But like, for really stateful objects, you get a bunch of interacting AIs like, that are depending on player state, and these doors are locked, but they weren't before, and the AIs. I mean, how do you like Hot Wheels? Are you guys have objects like that? Or?
Right, well, like I was talking about, Chris, if you reload the population file for a level, then you're going to restart the level from a known start of day state.
Right. It seems like as our levels get bigger, it seems like the harder problem is to reset through a stateful situation.
Right. And the way that we do that is that if you are resetting the properties that define the definition of some object, then you're going to delete that object and then recreate it again with a new definition, which works particularly well for objects like an animating device that's stationary, so it's going to be there in the same location. It doesn't work so well for an AI character that's running around. But basically what we do is that, I didn't really want to get into this in too much detail, but if you have a character definition and his health is 500, right, and then you change that to 300 and you sync it across, what happens is you have the choice in the callback functions for the game that are handling the new data. You can either decide that the data which is in the new tag matches my runtime state, so I don't need to do anything, or you can say, I give up, I punt, and then you punt on that, and the game will automatically delete you as an entity and then recreate you from your starting state. So that means if, for example, I want to change the color of somebody, I can handle that new data and copy it into the runtime state directly, or I have the choice that in code I can detect the discontinuity and just punt on it, which means I'll get recreated. And we found it's actually not that hard, because typically what happens is the default is just to punt on everything. The designers will come and say, you know, I was tweaking this guy's health and it wasn't really working very well, can we fix that? And then it's a 10-minute fix to go in and make sure that you handle that field changing. Other than that, interesting ways that this helps the process. It means that everybody gets in the mindset of, if it's working in the engine, then it's done. But if it's not completely working end-to-end, they don't consider the asset done. So it's the stimulus for your artist to want to go and bug the programmer, because they're actually looking at it and realizing that, hey, my animation compression or my interpolation looks wrong in this way. You know, what's wrong with that? It becomes largely transparent. So I talked earlier a little bit about level compiling. So the level compiling is the process that takes an 8,000 file development build and turns it into a one file compile build. The benefits of that are it's very fast load, memory optimal, but it's completely non-editable. It takes a compile time of maybe 10 minutes, tons of disk space. So you can either build that locally or you can build it on a build farm. One of the disadvantages of building it locally is the working set is about a gigabyte. So even if you have a lot of RAM, it will still tie up your machine quite effectively. And that's considering all the files that you load and also all of the memory state for having them in both the exploded form and also in the compiled form. So the way it works is it loads the level just like the game loads the level, like in every sense the same way as the game loading the level. And then after that, there are final post-processing that takes place where you go and strip debug information, or this character has these animations that will never be played in this level because the vehicles for those animations don't exist in that level. Things like that. We divide up the data and stream it out into partitions. The way the streaming works is that we pretty much have two main kinds of information. There's the information which is still in its tag format that is in all of the blocks that are exploded and linked together. And there's also the information that you yourself have in the post-process time put into a binary cacheable format and said, here's this blob, I want to refer to it later. So the way we do this is that we still have the introspection data, so we know how to stream out a tag structure given its hierarchy. And that streaming just consists of taking the tag blocks and laying them out end to end in the buffer, and then making the pointers point into the buffer. So what we do is, because we know we're going to load this on the console, we know for the global resource buffer it's always going to be loaded at a fixed virtual base address. So we can rebase the pointers, and then we basically can end up with a 6 to 8 megabyte buffer of all of the global resources in our game that we can map directly into memory, and it will be accessible, and there's really no work that needs to be done at all for it. So that has the disadvantage that all of that data is all memory resident all the time. So we divide it up also into loading zones. The zone-specific buffer is exactly like that, except you build all the zone-specific buffers after you have the global buffer built, because you know from the end of the global buffer what the virtual base address is where you're going to start mapping each zone in one at a time. And that, again, lets you rebase all of those pointers to map to that buffer. So that handles the tag data. The cache data is streamed out into different partitions. The partitions in the file, there's four of them for texture, geometry, sound, and animation, which correspond to our runtime caching method. and they're just cached out, and we write an offset to where that is into the tag structure. So the tag structure that's in the resource buffer contains a handle which tells you the offset in the file to go and get the cache data blocks from. And there's debug information which we'll write out, which will only be read back in a debugged version of the executable. So the total size for this is 180 to 270 megabytes for a single player and 50 to 80 megabytes for multiplayer mem. And we zlib compress that and store it on the DVD, and we do the unzip operation from copying from the DVD to the hard drive. So these 180 to 270 megabyte files are on the hard drive at the time we load the level, and that's the only kind of streaming we do is from the hard drive. So one problem is that there's duplication of data across levels. If you've got 10 levels and each of them load a vehicle, that vehicle is going to exist in 10 different places. So our solution is to allow the ability for a cache file to depend on another cache file. And what we do is we create a shared custom scenario, which is basically just a little box level containing a bunch of vehicles and characters standing around. So that scenario is a level, it's a first-class citizen every sense of the word, but it's going to pull in all of the resources that we want for our shared map file. So we actually build a cache file directly for the shared scenario, and then what happens is after you have built that shared cache file, you also at the same time have built a database which says, here are all of the resources which are stored in those cached data blocks, that is all the bitmap pixels, all the sound data, and so on. You know where they are in the file, you know what the tag was that generated them, and you have a hash as to what their size and content was. So that database is stored as well. Then the next time you go to build a next cache file, like a single player file, that contains information about which scenarios it depends on. And when you go to write a block to file, you do a hash lookup. If it's identical to a block that exists in a dependent file, you just write the offset of the other file instead. So essentially, now you can load the level exactly like you would before. It's just that instead of opening one file on the hard drive for caching, you're opening three in this case. And what happens is the shared map file actually still contains like the resource buffers that are needed for that shared file. So you can actually load it as a real level. We just didn't bother stripping any of that out. And this cuts the size of a single player file down from 700 megabytes to 270 megabytes, because the majority of that is stuff like combat dialogue, which is shared across a lot of different levels. But without that, we would not fit on a DVD. And you don't need to do this in order to build a cache file. You can just build a cache file locally, which contains everything. It'll be the 700 megabyte file. And you don't need to update the shared file every time you want to build, because since the shared file contains checksums to the data that's there, if you have different data, then that data will just not be shared. So you could build the shared file at the start of the week, and then over time, your files that you build will get bigger and bigger because there's less sharing, but it doesn't matter. There actually are a set of shared files. There's one for single player, one for multiplayer, and we also made the main menu be a shared file because we have to load the main menu first, and we know it's always going to be on the hard drive, and it contains a bunch of data that we can share. So yes, we copy from DVD to hard drive and decompress, which basically lets us load really quickly. So we page in those two buffers I talked about, the global resource buffer and the zone resource buffer, page them directly in a known virtual base address, reads in much less than 1 second. And there's no iteration necessary because all of those pointers to different tag data has been rebased already, and it just works. Well, not strictly, because unfortunately we want to store a bunch of Havoc data in our tags as well, and Havoc is very C++ driven and has lots of virtual tables, so we have to go in and fix up the V tables on any Havoc classes that are stored inside there. So it actually is kind of a bit of an end run around the system, and it doesn't take too long. It doesn't mean we have to iterate over the entire, 12 meg buffer, but that's not really so bad. And we know where all the tags that can contain Havoc data are stored in there anyway, so it's fairly quick. So that takes much less than 1 second, and then basically you have to do that part synchronously when you hit a level transition, but all the rest is just your game loop running. You can't actually start gameplay immediately because none of your caches will be warm with all of the new geometry and stuff like that for the new level. But as far as everything else is concerned, like networking, UI, input, and so on, the level is loaded, and then you just have to warm up for some period before you can render the first frame. So our memory layout, 64 megs of physical memory. I went through and looked at this, and I was startled. This figure for 13.9 megabytes, this is essentially memory that we don't have control over in our memory map. That's higher than I remember it being. I'm not sure how it got so high. I'm going to investigate some more. But that contains everything that's not essentially resources that we read from the file I was telling you about. So a kernel, executable, static globals, heap, libraries, any globals in the library. We have our world state buffer, which is 4 megabytes. This is our save game buffer as well. The second half of my talk is talking about what's in that buffer, but I'm not going to do that. So we also have various things that are allocated only on certain level loads. So networking has got a big buffer, which is allocated only in multiple layer levels, for example. And then in our memory layout, we have the tag resource buffers, which per level, we know the size of that is the size of the global buffer plus the maximum of any zone that we could potentially load that level. So there's a balancing act between global stuff and per zone stuff, but the budget is 12 megabytes or less, and we were under that for everything. Some levels had only 7 megabytes of global buffers. So everything else goes in the dynamic caches. So that's what I'm going to talk about next. Four caches. The 3 megabyte single player animation cache, which is 4 megabytes for multiplayer. This is kind of counterintuitive, but the reason for that is because in single player, you've got lots more characters running around, but those characters generally are pretty predictable. In multiplayer, you've only got two characters that can be running around, the two different playable characters, but players are so unpredictable, they can switch weapons and jump in vehicles at any point, so you basically have to have the entirety of their animation graphs loaded all the time. So the cacheable data size is between 8 and 19 megabytes for animations, typically. Page size is very small. I'm not going to talk very much about what's inside the pages, but the page size is small because the animation granularity is small. Sound cache is 3 megabytes, which is accessing 3 to 500 megabytes of cacheable data, but sound streams really well, so that's why we have such a small cache. Geometry is everything that is kind of about rendering. It's not just vertices, it's also all of the information that we need to render that character. So it's vertices, indices, and information about how you stitch the character up. And we could have put shaders in there as well, but didn't end up doing that because it wasn't worthwhile. So 6.5 megabytes or 7 megabytes if you have the potential for split screen. And yes. So texture cache is everything else, because textures are still our far and away the largest memory consumer. And the reason that it's the largest one is it grows in size, so it consumes all of the remaining space. Halo 1's texture cache was 22 megabytes. So this is low. This actually is too low. One of the reasons why you see texture popping all over Halo 2 is because we basically could not finish all of our memory optimization work. So what happens is the texture cache shrinks. And other systems temporarily steal from the texture cache, like asynchronous file I/O and stuff like that. And 80 to 140 megabytes of cacheable data. So we're running low on time because I started digressing about a bunch of stuff. So I'm going to skip past the second part of the talk, which is essentially talking about how do we store memory at runtime. Essentially, we have per system, memory is compartmentalized. We don't have global interactions between systems as far as memory goes. So that lets us decouple and bound all of our failure cases, whether it's running out of effects or running out of object room and stuff like that. There is no global allocation in Halo 2, period, except for stuff that the system does, and except for Havoc, again. We have a direct map from memory to our save game. We have a 4 megabyte memory buffer that contains everything that is our runtime world state. And just like the tags, essentially, you have a direct mapping from the disk format to the in-memory format. Again, you basically memcopy to go to disk for a save game. That's very quick and also has very good reproducibility, so it allows us to integrate that with all of our automated back-end tools to capture automated bug reports. Very useful. And lastly, we enforce a high degree of interoperability. We try very hard to decouple our runtime data state from the code you are running right now. By that I mean we make the shipping Xbox version as close as possible to the debug PC version and everything else from the perspective of our data layout and data storage, to the point where you can interoperate save games between release and debug versions even though they are essentially just a 4 megabyte core file that you have dumped out of your saved game. And it results in dramatically less bugs that occur only in the shipping version that we found so far. In summary, so we made a lot of interesting choices here. Most of these are pretty simple choices, I think. They're simple to make, but have very wide range engine implications. So I'm curious to see the rest of the talks today, see how they map. But I hope you found that interesting.
All right, thanks, Chris. Okay, as regards Q&A, we're going to have to be a little bit creative because lunch is kind of inflexible because the hotel staff is going to come in here and serve lunch from 12:30 to 2, during which time we're going to have also a sponsored session from ATI. So we're going to do some Q&A now and some as lunch comes in, and then, you know, maybe after lunch we'll do a little bit if we're on a hot topic, and otherwise we do have some time slated at the end of the day when we can continue it. And also, Chris had about 10 more slides, and maybe we could do some of that. But for now, questions? Yes, Casey. Hold on. Let me get the mic over there. Or start talking, and I'll get the mic over there.
Pretty simple question, Chris. I would have expected, given the way that the system was laid out, that at some point you would have started just saving your type descriptors to disk. Because, I mean, that's the typical way these things work, right? You know, you like save it. But you never did that. So I'm curious, did you guys, like, decide, did you not have time, or did you actually think that, like, it's better to keep all of the type structures in code redundantly all the time? Instead of just, you know, with the file so that you could do conversion that way.
So our versioning system was written by somebody who was new to the team and pretty senior but should have known better. I'm not very happy with it, but none of us had any time to go and rewrite fundamental stuff like that. It's one of the first things we are addressing right now. Yeah, I agree. What you should be doing is you should have a self-describing data format, whether it is textual or whether it's because your data descriptors are prepended to the start of every file. Yeah, no brainer.
So exactly how painful was changing a structure?
Well, I could show you some code, but I don't think that's the most useful way of doing it. Essentially, suppose you have a C structure that is, you know, 16 bytes long, and you want to add something to it. Well, when the versioning stuff came online, which was only for Halo 2, there was no versioning at all for Halo 1. Then you could add fields at the bottom of that tag block quite simply. But before then, you would have to look for unused space in the block. And in fact, in general, what you would do is you would create blocks and put, you know, long pad 32 so that you had space to add stuff later. And then, of course, that defers the burden until later, because then you start running out of memory and you have to go through and reclaim that space. At one point, we a couple of our guys spent like a week just going through and writing an automated process to find people who had long pad 8 in their structures and then write the versioning tools to go and remove them automatically. So but it is really painful because you're taking over some unused field and you have to check, you know, is anybody using this functionality, or, okay, this field is described as a pad field right now, which means anybody that loads a tag right now before I do anything, that field's going to be zero initialized. But you don't know if the tag was saved at a time when that field was a zero initialized field. If there are legacy tags lying around, they could be from a time before when that field was in fact something else, and you have no way of knowing. So it really was a minefield.
How did you deal with non-serializable data in the structures?
There is no non-serializable data in any of our structures.
Really? Everything is...
Everything is serializable, with the exception of Havoc.
Okay. And you don't have... You manually created the tags. You didn't run a preprocessor over your C files.
You manually created the definition macros, you mean? Yes.
That you have to kind of manually version, and then also with the binary save games. I've heard a lot of disadvantages to those things. Maybe you could kind of summarize the advantages and why you guys think they're still a good way to go.
advantages the binary data format?
Well, the primary advantage of the binary data format is that it actually allows us to have a development build that loads from that, and it loads in essentially interactive time, in 1 to 4 minutes again. If that was a text-based data format, you would not be able to load that in a comparable amount of time. Essentially, you would have a process where there is a pre-baking state, and then you'd have essentially the binary version of the text format, which is still platform neutral or so on. It's just a different way of structuring what is platform neutral, what is platform specific, and what it means to bake an asset. We chose to make those binary because it was a closer map initially to, I think, the structures that we had been using. And part of it, I think, is that the structures back when the Halo engine was first starting up were not edited that often. Pretty much it was more about creating systems and less about maintaining systems. Obviously, with an engine that has more maturity, the balance shifts, and so those design decisions become different. Like I say, I think it would be better for us to use a self-describing format. Well, essentially, we do two things. The first thing is that we have some metrics that you can use which are independent of whether you're running with a development build or a final build, like number of vertices rendered in the scene and total texture size used. Because remember, I was talking about, like, at post-process time, you load those things in, you convert them to a platform-specific format, then you save out the cacheable data block. So the size of that cacheable data block is going to be identical between the development build and the final monolithic build, if that makes sense. So you still have all of the four caches I talked about in the development build. It's just that those caches are populated with blocks that were generated when you loaded the level, rather than those caches being populated with blocks at the time you compiled the level. So a lot of those metrics still apply, although not all of them. And like I said, if we do any profiling, your profiling needs to take place in the compiled level form because your data locality is so different.
So it seems to me that you've got a very good resource model, largely because it's shared and everything uses it. And in exchange for that, thanks. In exchange for that, you've taken some code maintenance overhead because some stuff that could be considered metadata is really stored in your code. Is the fact that you get so much payoff from this something that would transfer to any team, or is it a function of the type and number of engineers that you have and the type of work that they do?
I could take the easy way out and say it depends, but I think the answer is basically that in any situation where you have multiple clients of a single system, then the balance of work is shifted towards the person who's developing the system rather than the clients of the system. And a surprisingly small amount of time is actually used in setting up those tag structures. Because remember, only when you're actually changing the fundamental format of your data do you need to worry about changing the tag structures. If you are extending a format, if you are adding more options and more flexibility for artists, what we find is you're adding enumerated types, you're adding flags, fields, you're handling more cases that you did not anticipate. Not much of that actually involves extending your data format in terms of adding new fields. Surprisingly small amount of that. And also, it's not impossible to add by any means. It really is a very simple engineering task. And this kind of comes back a little bit to what Jay was talking about. They have a very strong separation between system coders and leaf coders. We do not, because pretty much our leaf gameplay is built up by our designers messing with values. Because we have this very generic editing thing, basically, a lot of what you could build with gameplay code, we end up building out of building blocks using this kind of mentality. So we tend to end up building more general systems, and I would say almost all of our coders are system coders. we have only two or three coders who are leaf coders.
It's a quick one. When you're doing your pointer rebasing, are you using your introspectable data to identify, oh, look, this is a pointer, and do you then do it automatically by iterating across all the structures using the introspection data?
Yep.
Or, okay, so each individual class doesn't have to, like, understand what pointer is it. Okay.
Actually, I have a kind of related question that I want to throw in really fast. A lot of the, like, PC games that do this kind of thing use a slightly different methodology to the reloading, where the resource is almost like a header block, and it has a pointer to the dynamic data, right? So if it's a sound effect, maybe you have identifying information and then a pointer to the samples, right? And so if you reload that, you can recycle that address for the same resource, and various other parts of the code don't have to chase pointers and find them, because the pointer is constant once you load
it, right? And that's exactly what we do. Yeah.
Oh, do you? It's because kind of like, because you were talking about the thing where a character maybe has an animation and you didn't want to point at the animation, you wanted to deduce it from
right. When I talk about the handle to a tag, what that is, that's an index into a global table, which is the headers for each of these tags.
Okay.
So that's what you would refer to if you're using something. So if I have a sound effect that I'm going to play, or if I have some effect that I'm going to start with parameters, then I store a reference to that tag, and that reference is turned into a handle at the time we actually compile the file. So then that handle I store is always going to be immutable, and then after reload, the handle is just going to point to a different chaining area of memory. Okay, all you have to fix up is if you have anything that depends on the internal structure of what's underneath what you're pointing at. And that's what I was saying. There's actually a very limited number of places where you want to do that. They're pretty much only for optimization reasons.
Okay.
And everything else is late bound.
So, yeah, I think that when you mentioned the code difficulty question, like, that sort of brought that up, because I was unclear. Yeah, it sounds a lot easier.
There's not that much maintenance work involved. It really is a cultural thing. And it's one of the reasons we've had a hard time growing our engineering team, is because there's a big overhead to kind of get into this mentality, but once you're there, it's very fast.
Right. Just real quick, I have a question. I just wanted to address the one comment you just made, though. We don't have very many leaf coders versus system coders, actually. We have a lot of people who do both. So we do, like you were saying, though, we do write a lot of game code, it sounds like, that you guys would do in design. Usually, it's the same people who do
that
systems.
Makes sense. Sure.
But it's just like different demands while you're doing that. But the question I had was about you're saying you can mem copy your state off the disk. It seems like at some point you're going to have to break that. All right. Did you break it? Did you have to?
Well, there are routines that run before and after save and before and after load. There are not very many of them. Mostly what the routines are is 90% of them are things that you apply which are fix-ups after you load. So basically that is because we want the act of saving the game not to modify the game state. It does, unfortunately, again, because of Havoc. But the reason that we push that stuff off to after load is that what happens is you load the core file that you saved off, and then there are pieces of that state that have references to non-deterministic, non-game code. For example, your game objects store rendering information in them. You want to go and null that information out, but typically it's quite straightforward to go and null that out and then attach it, if necessary, to your current non-deterministic state. For example, controller was in port 1 at the time you saved, is now in port 0. So there is the ability if you do flexible remapping there, but that's usually quite limited in scope.
I guess I'm asking more like during development where, you know, you wanted to change a bunch of implementation and you've got to orphan a bunch of save files. I'm asking, like, when did that happen?
Oh, we do that continuously. Pretty much the only time you could have a save file that would be valid across multiple executable versions is towards the very end of the project when, as I say, no one is changing data structures anymore. But there's not even any versioning to that besides just the build number of the executable.
Okay, so you did it all the time.
Yeah, if the build number is different in any way, then it by default won't let you load, but as a programmer you can say, I'm going to be unsafe, try and load it anyway.
So then did your bug reporter archive the build that you're running as well as the save files? Or did you only use it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right.
So basically, there's another talk in that whole thing, but when the crash upload happens, it uploads three things, stack trace and the core file at the time that it crashed, and also a complete mini dump of the box. So then you have three options. You can load the mini dump and look at it, or you can say, you go to a website, put in the IP address of your Xbox and say, propagate this build and reproduce the bug. And it will propagate that version of the build down to your machine with the map file for the level it was running. It'll load the save game from that frame or 1 second or 30 seconds before and drop it up and put you in the debugger.